These voices made headlines this week.
This is a big and dangerous hurricane. It's not the biggest we've ever seen, but it is really a big one and a dangerous one.
Make no mistake, there is no such thing as a conventional nuclear weapon.
Now is not the time to talk of negotiations in Southeast Asia.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sound of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines. The voices which were in the headlines this week were speaking in stormy times. Military revolt in South Vietnam, the tempest of American politics, and hurricanes. Hurricanes born in the tropics and hurling themselves northward.
This is a big and dangerous hurricane. It's not the biggest we've ever seen, but it is really a big one and a dangerous one. And I might emphasize that anyone along the coastal areas that'll be north of the center would be in considerable danger, I would say, from water and tides and even wind. But the top of the water would be the greatest damage.
Weather Bureau spokesman Harry Armstrong in Washington warned of the approach of the season's fourth hurricane, named Dora, a swirling savage storm bearing down on Florida and Georgia, and a threat to the entire Southland. That was how this week began. And by Tuesday, the Miami Weather Bureau warned...
Hurricane Dora continues to move steadily westward about 15 miles per hour. All interests in the area of warning displays should take necessary precautions against high winds and tides, and especially in the area of hurricane display.
Dora was a big storm with winds well over 100 miles an hour, churning high tides and battering surf, taking a bead on the sun-washed beaches of Florida.
The storm had kind of stalled and just sitting out there, moving very slowly to the west. The winds have decreased, and all of our operations, of course, are from now on will be dependent after the storm strikes.
Dora was an unpredictable storm. She moved slowly, keeping weathermen and civil defense workers guessing. For a time, it appeared that Dora would slam into the United States Space Center at Cape Kennedy. Jack King of NASA told ABC about the storm preparations.
We're presently in hurricane condition 3. We in the space agency, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, have 5 launch vehicles out on our pads at Cape Kennedy in preparation for upcoming launches. The plan presently is to take 4 of these launch vehicles down and leave one up. The one that will ride out this storm is our upcoming Saturn.
But Cape Kennedy was spared the full fury of Dora as the vicious hurricane slammed into the resort area around Jacksonville, Florida. Peter Upton of the Red Cross reported.
There's bad erosion on the beaches and also some heavy property damage along the waterfront. Several breaks in the seawall. The amusement park at Jacksonville Beach, about a third of it, has been washed out into sea and it's crumbling away at the present time. Highway 1A1 from Jacksonville Beach to St. Augustine has been closed. It's flooded and is breaking up in spots and floating out into the sea.
Tides in Jacksonville Beach ran 10 feet above normal. Thousands of persons were evacuated to inland areas. And on Thursday, Red Cross spokeswoman Peggy Giff reported.
We have had winds up to 100 miles an hour or more. The devastation is quite vast. Trees are down, lines are down. The city has been without power. Over 85% of it has been without power now for 10 hours at least. The beach area is completely devastated.
The force of Dora did its greatest damage to property and to the beaches in the Jacksonville area. Its mighty winds battered into Georgia also, but advance warning reduced serious human casualties. Then Dora passed inland, diminishing in power, until Sunday, when she was reborn over the Atlantic into another threatening tropical storm. But as Dora moved away from Florida, Governor Ferris Bryant asked for federal help.
I have conveyed to President Johnson the latest information about the disaster which has occurred in Florida and advised him that I was wiring him simultaneously, asking for an emergency declaration of a major disaster area.
Governor Bryant of Florida was joined in his appeal for federal assistance by the governor of Georgia, Carl Sanders.
He advised me that he was aware of the fact that the Georgia coast had been battered by the Hurricane Dora, that there was considerable damage that had been occurred in that area, and that if we would expedite the papers, which would permit him to declare this a major disaster area, that he would do so immediately.
At week's end, President Johnson, reacting to the appeal from storm-battered Florida and Georgia, went to the hurricane area for a personal look at the damage. The president said,
"The Army Corps of Engineers is already busy on plans to assist in the rebuilding of your public beaches. The Small Business Administration has already established offices throughout the state to handle small business disaster loans."
As President Johnson moved to feed federal government resources to aid the victims of Dora, a stormy lady named Ethel brushed by Bermuda, another powerful Atlantic storm, with the hurricane season far from over.
Politics and poker, politics and poker, makes the average guy a heavy smoker.
The classical American game, politics. President Johnson's opening bid at Detroit's Cadillac Square with a Labor Day speech. Senator Barry Goldwater campaigned in the far west and promised a 1/4 cut in federal income taxes.
The initial request would provide for such regular, prudent reductions in taxes in each of the next 5 years. For example, at the end of the first year, you would calculate the tax you owed under the present law, and you would reduce it by 5%. At the end of the second year, you would reduce the payment by 10%. And each year, you would take off the 5% so that the end of the fifth year, the total reduction would be 25%.
Senator Goldwater himself was the topic for President Johnson, who referred to Senator Goldwater's promise of a choice, not an echo, in this year's election. In that Detroit speech, the president said,
"The majority says yes to equal rights for all, equal hope for all, equal happiness for all. But the echo still says no. This year, the mighty voice of the American majority will be heard throughout our land."
President Johnson was discussing domestic policies, while Senator Goldwater turned increasingly toward foreign affairs and announced the establishment of a Republican task force on foreign policy.
"This task force will cover all major foreign policy issues, paying particular attention to the key question of how to keep the peace throughout this world. This task force will also concentrate on studying measures to extend freedom, especially those necessary to halt the spread of communism and eventually roll back its offensive or force a change in its intentions."
The president continued on the main theme of his campaign, the need for unity in the nation. Unity coupled with what the president said is the need for responsibility in the use of America's power.
"There are abroad in this responsible land reckless factions, contemptuous toward the will of majorities, callous toward the plight of minorities, arrogant toward allies, belligerent toward adversaries, careless toward peace."
And President Johnson's opening campaign speech in Detroit touched on the Democrats' charge that Senator Barry Goldwater does not fully appreciate the dangers of national existence in the age of nuclear weapons.
"I am not the first president to speak here in Cadillac Square, and I do not intend to be the last. Make no mistake, there is no such thing as a conventional nuclear weapon."
President Johnson was but one of a number of top Democrats who directed their political ammunition in the direction of Senator Barry Goldwater. The same charge of an irresponsible Goldwater leadership in the nuclear age was made by Arkansas Senator J. William Fulbright.
My guess is that a Goldwater administration would be less likely to launch a nuclear conflict than to provoke or stumble into one inadvertently. But this is hardly important, for who would there be after so great a Holocaust to know or care how it had begun?
Senator Fulbright attacked not only Senator Goldwater, but the philosophy of the Arizona senator.
Goldwater Republicanism is the closest thing in American politics to an equivalent of Russian Stalinism. Each makes a religion of its ideology. The Stalinists of communism, the Goldwaterites of their own special concept of freedom. Each is convinced that there can be no peace in the world until its own ideology is universally practiced.
Senator Fulbright was answered by Republican vice presidential nominee William Miller.
Who is this senator to stand up and spew forth his venomous predictions that Senator Goldwater as president would generate new international conflicts? He is the same Senator William Fulbright who has come before the nation time and again as an apostle of retreat and as the launcher of trial balloons whenever there is a new policy of accommodation to be tested.
Besides Congressman Miller, another leading Republican came to Senator Goldwater's defense. Senator Everett Dirksen, who fought for the civil rights law, said he believed Senator Goldwater would enforce the law as president. Senator Dirksen said,
"You got to say this for him, that Senator Goldwater will not toy with that sort of business. The law is the law, and the law was meant to be enforced. And if it isn't enforced, you get no confidence in the law. And what happens then to the morale of your people?"
As the campaign rolled into September, Senator Goldwater led the GOP in an attack on President Johnson's past relationship with Bobby Baker. On Wednesday, on the West Coast, Senator Goldwater referred to the president when he said,
"Their leader wants to forget even his own old friends such as Bobby Baker, Billy Saul Estes. Now, maybe their leader will forget it. Maybe a lot of the columnists will forget it. But the American people will not forget it."
Bobby Baker was not forgotten this week. The Democratic leadership of the Senate bowed to GOP demands and reopened the investigation of Baker, a former aide to Senate Democrats while President Johnson was Senate Majority Leader. As for the renewed Senate investigation, Senator Carl Curtis told ABC,
"As I see it, it's a choice of whether to have the Rules Committee reopen it or to have the Government Operations Committee under Senator McClellan conduct the investigation. I favor the McClellan Committee. Furthermore, the Rules Committee have refused to investigate."
Senator Curtis also answered the charge by Democrats that Republicans were going out of their way to link Bobby Baker with the president.
"The president associated himself with Bobby Baker. He is his protege. He was his man in the Senate all through the years. This is no artificial association on the part of the Republicans."
Senator Carl Curtis's remarks on the Baker-Johnson relationship were amplified by the GOP presidential nominee, Barry Goldwater.
"As a matter of record, the only genuine anti-poverty programs Lyndon Johnson can claim are the kind he and Bobby Baker set up for themselves."
Senator Goldwater, Senator Curtis, the president, and the vice presidential candidates in both parties indicated by their speeches this week that personalities would be issues in this campaign. The GOP turned campaign oratory against United Nations Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, whom they said was in favor of civil rights demonstrators accepting jail sentences with pride. Senator Goldwater charged,
"We Americans can't forget that while brave and honest men were trying to enforce the law, a major spokesman for this administration
was exhorting college students to consider breaking the law.
Senator Goldwater's running mate, William Miller, had a promise regarding Adlai Stevenson's future.
This I promise you. When Senator Goldwater is inaugurated on January 20th, 1965, Adlai Stevenson is through.
Ambassador Stevenson came to his own defense in a speech in Minneapolis, a speech aimed in part at Senator Goldwater.
I hope I have misinterpreted these sometimes contradictory sounds, but if I have not, and the proposition is that the existence of more than one set of beliefs in the world is intolerable, I must confess my profound alarm.
Ambassador Stevenson also spoke at the United Nations this week when the Security Council heard Malaysian charges of aggression by Indonesia. Ambassador Stevenson warned,
"This council cannot condone the use of force in international relations outside the framework of the Charter. This council must try to recreate the conditions of peace and security in the area of conflict to enable the processes of peaceful settlement to move these two nations away from the precipice of war."
The UN delegate from Indonesia took the floor to deny charges of aggression and to ask,
"Why is Malaysia so greatly concerned now that it requests a meeting of the Security Council? Why was it not equally concerned much earlier when the fighting broke out in Sarawak and Sabah? An official of the Kuala Lumpur government even stated that these so-called incursions on Malaya were ill-planned, ill-timed, and doomed to failure. Why then all the fuss?"
The fuss was based on Malaysia's long-standing dispute with neighboring Indonesia, a dispute that has flared in guerrilla warfare in some areas of Malaysia. Appealing for peace was Britain's Sir Patrick Dean.
"My delegation believes the Security Council should, in these circumstances, deal with the situation it has been called upon to consider, and strongly condemn such attacks, and should call for an unequivocal assurance that they will not recur again."
The Malaysian representative restated his charges before the Security Council.
"I shall, for the occasion, content myself with stating, with all the emphasis at my command, and with full knowledge of our responsibility, that we are in a position to establish without a shadow of doubt that this was calculated Indonesian aggression, carefully planned and skillfully organized against Malaysia."
South Vietnam, trouble spot of Southeast Asia, where more than a decade of jungle warfare against the communists has been continually harassed by the lack of stable government in Saigon. Sunday, September 13th, a military coup in Vietnam. General Lan Van Phat, backed by 2,000 rebel troops, rolled into Saigon, pledging to arrest Premier Khan as a traitor. It was a coup much like the one which brought Khan himself to power less than a year ago. General Khan vowed to fight, and the war against the communists took a back seat to South Vietnamese internal disorders. It happened while U.S. Ambassador Maxwell Taylor was returning to Saigon following high-level talks in Washington. Congressman Clement Zablocki of the House Foreign Affairs Committee reported on Ambassador Taylor's testimony.
"He did not see an end to the war in Vietnam in the foreseeable future, but he certainly did emphasize that a victory in Vietnam is not only possible, but will become a reality."
What about victory in Vietnam? Congressman Zablocki said,
"The military victory in South Vietnam is possible, but a military victory alone is not the solution to South Vietnam. It'll also have to be a political victory, and they are interdependent."
Then Ambassador Taylor spoke to newsmen and said the Premier of South Vietnam, General Khan, had a plan for bringing stability to his government.
"He has set 2 months as the period of time for this preliminary work of establishing such a government, and feels that shortly thereafter he will have a provisional government which will have a broad base and should be able to pursue the campaign against the Viet Cong with added strength and effectiveness."
But by week's end, the fate of the Khan government remained in doubt, and the war with the communists marked time during Saigon's own governmental crisis. In his Washington talks, before the attempted coup on Sunday, Ambassador Taylor was asked about the possibility of negotiations in the war with the communists.
Of course, the word negotiation has acquired an evil connotation. I would point out that all wars that I can recall end in negotiation. But now is not the time to talk of negotiation in Southeast Asia.
Then on Sunday, the coup, and a new question mark over inscrutable Vietnam. In London, talks opened between the British and the Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia. The aim of the talks, independence. Southern Rhodesia's Prime Minister, Ian Smith, said,
"Politically, as well as economically, there is no doubt in our minds, and we believe in the minds of any clear-thinking people, once they have all the facts put before them, and once they have analyzed the case as well and as many times as we have, that if Southern Rhodesia is to thrive and indeed to survive, we have got to have independence."
Talks of a different nature in the United States, as Chrysler and the United Auto Workers agreed on a new contract. Chrysler Vice President John O'Leary said,
"On behalf of Chrysler Corporation, we are pleased that we were able to arrive at a settlement which we believe is good for our employees, good for Chrysler Corporation, its shareholders and dealers, and everyone concerned, as a matter of fact."
United Auto Workers Chief Walter Reuther was happy with the Chrysler contract.
"I would like to point out that I believe that the agreement that we have reached in this marathon set of negotiations is the most historic agreement in the history of the American labor movement with respect to the broad problem of pension security for workers."
These other voices made headlines this week.
"Unilateral disarmament for Britain today could only put us out of business in the international councils of the world, just at the moment when there is so much business to be done by Britain in the cause of peace."
Britain's Prime Minister, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, opening his campaign in Britain's national election. The Conservatives campaigning to remain in office. The opposition is led by the Labour Party's Harold Wilson.
"Our appeal then is to the people of Britain to recognize that we can do better than we are doing, that with extra effort and partnership, we can have better education, better housing, better social security, and ever-widening fields of opportunity for all our people."
One other voice in the headlines this week. In an interview with ABC, Peggy Goldwater, wife of the GOP presidential candidate, was asked if she was sometimes hurt by the political slings and arrows aimed at her husband. Mrs. Goldwater said,
"Well, yes, it does at times. I don't think my skin is quite as thick as his as far as the cartoons and the articles that have been written, but..."
It doesn't upset him?
Well, he doesn't let it show if it does.
So went This World This Week, and the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by Paul Jeffers. Directed by Joe Dennehy. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering by Jack Wilkie, Henry Zeitlinger, and Pete Sarantopoulos. Your narrator, Fred Foy.
America's Cup races, described from an overhead blimp. Only on the ABC Radio Network.